Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition National Political Director Phil Smith and Executive Director Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. President Trump signed an $855.1 billion spending package that, at least temporarily, averted a partial government shutdown, which would have begun October 1st. The new deadline to pass full fiscal year funding is December 7th. Depending upon how the November midterm elections shake out, Congress may have difficulty passing the remainder of the appropriations bills. Between now and then, the House will be in recess. President Trump's top spending priority, a $5 billion down payment on a border wall, was not included in the package he signed. Finalizing a Homeland Security bill that addresses the politically challenging issue of border wall funding will likely be one of the larger fights in the appropriations process ahead. But with the majority of the 12 spending bills still unfinished, there could be many more conflicts. President Trump hailed a trade pact that could replace NAFTA with the expressed purpose of reducing trade deficits. But the agreement's future rests in the hands of Congress. Regional trade priorities may complicate its path as a result, not to mention Mexico and Canada have to get it through their own parliamentary process, and Congress might not even act on it until next year. The House passed H.R. 6756 and H.R. 6557, collectively known as, quote, Tax Reform 2.0. The two bills would extend the tax breaks for individuals, retirement savings, and small businesses. The Senate does not intend to take up either of them this year. Concord's National Political Director Phil Smith will join me next to provide an update on recent field activities and discuss ways individuals, like yourself, can get more involved. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord's National Political Director, Phil Smith. Phil travels the country working with volunteers. He directs and conducts a lot of grassroots activities for the Concord Coalition, and he's been on the show before, so welcome back, Phil.
Thank you so much, Chase. It's great to be with you today.
Well, obviously, I'm happy to have you on the show since you're a colleague of mine, but I wanted to have you on specifically to talk about what Concord is doing at a grassroots level across the nation, what kind of activities we do, and you know what kind of success our volunteers are actually having. So maybe if you would give us a quick update on what's been keeping you busy and what's been keeping some of our volunteer leaders busy.
Thank you, Chase. I appreciate the chance to talk about our volunteers, or as we call them at the Concord Coalition, our fiscal lookouts. And we have fiscal lookouts all across the country. We have supporters of the Concord Coalition nationwide, but there's probably about a dozen states where we have some really vibrant volunteer activity going on. And there's so many ways that citizens are supporting Concord or they're getting involved with Concord. And of course, the core of it all is to get educated about these issues. And so we have this happening all across the country. In fact, just Sunday, I was at the University of Houston. There was supposed to be a Senate debate down there between, you probably heard about this race, Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz. They unfortunately postponed their Senate debate, but we went ahead with our doing our exercise, our budget exercise down there on their campus. And it was really a terrific event, and it brought together a wide variety of people, as our events often do, to get educated about budget issues. And one of the ways I love our exercise so much, because people get educated by doing. So we give a really good speech at the Concord Coalition. If you've been to your local Rotary Club and you know, heard Chase Hageman or Tyler Sweeney or somebody give a good Rotary Club speech or a Kiwanis Club speech. Those are really good. But when we run these exercises, I think people learn even more because they get their hands dirty and try to solve the budget challenges in groups. So we were doing that in Texas on Sunday, and then this coming Thursday, I'll be on the campus of the University of Minnesota, the Humphrey Center, and they're also hosting us in our exercise. One of our board members, former Congressman Tim Penny, who used to represent the 1st District of Minnesota, will be on hand with us to do all of this. And each of these events, the thing that all of these events have in common is they are created and basically managed, organized by volunteers. So in Texas, we've got a great guy down there that is based near the Austin area, near state capital down there, and he's been helping us out. And then in Minnesota, we have a Minnesota Advisory Council, much like we do in New Hampshire, where this group has just really gone overboard planning for this upcoming meeting at the University of Minnesota.
And Phil, you mentioned a couple of the typical sort of grassroots activities that the Concord Coalition conducts and volunteers are able to facilitate. One was the budget exercise, and the other was a presentation that we typically do with civic organizations like Rotary or Kiwanis. Can you give just a quick rundown of what those two activities entail and maybe how they're a little different?
Yeah, sure. So, I'll take the speech first because that's, if, you know, if you guys or anybody in the listening audience out there is a member of a local civic club or organization that needs a speaker, we have really got this wonderful 20-minute presentation down pat. And we have these dramatic charts that we show that will help educate people about why our current fiscal policy is unsustainable. There's a lot of myths out there about federal budget issues. So in this 20-minute speech, we basically lay out, you know, the big challenges, and we, you know, let people know that there's no easy solutions, such as, you know, we always hear, oh, if we just cut out that waste, fraud, and abuse, or we can just grow our way out of the problem. And we show people why, you know, even though those things are important, we should always cut waste, fraud, and abuse, and economic growth is a wonderful thing that we should all strive for. Those aren't the magic bullet solutions to these massive, massive fiscal challenges that we have. So in these 20-minute speeches, the audience is able to interact through Q&A, and they're able to really get a good explanation, and it's a wonderful way to have public engagement. So that's the speech. And the exercise is called Principles and Priorities. The exercise is great for college campuses or for churches. Basically, we need about an hour and a half, even 2 hours if we could get that much time. And we've done it with groups as small as, you know, a dozen or so people, and as many, if you can believe it, as many as like 400 or 500 people in that large of a setting. The ideal size seems to be about 50 to 70, I think, if you can kind of get that size. But again, we can work with any group. And in this budget simulation, it's basically a congressional role-playing exercise where people come in and they decide what their 10-year budget is going to be for the federal budget. So they get to go and make the decisions on what to cut and what to keep. But there's one big caveat, and that is they have to do it in these groups. Because if you think about it, it's kind of easy for an individual to do it. I mean, they could just go through and check the box, oh, I like this, I don't like that, and put together their own budget. The challenge is when you have to use those two ears that God gave you and only one mouth and listen to other people's principles and other people's priorities, and then when you have a chance to speak, try to explain your principles and explain your priorities, and then majority rules. If you have a tie or if you don't get a majority, then that option fails. And basically, using about 39 or 40 different options scored by the Congressional Budget Office, people are able to put together their own 10-year budget. And every single time I do this, again, I was in Texas doing this on Sunday, it just blows me away how the citizens are so far ahead of their elected officials. They always, always come up with a better plan than Congress or the president has come up with so far, than any Congress or any president has come up with to date on how to fix our budget by putting together a 10-year budget plan.
And Phil, I liked how you factored in the name of the budget exercise in your explanation there, Principles and Priorities. That was very clever. And I might have been the guinea pig for size on some of the groups we've done this exercise with. I've worked with literally a dozen people, an executive group for an organization. We did the budget exercise, and I've done it with over 300 college students. We worked with an accounting fraternity a couple of years ago, and we had a massive scale budget exercise. So that was a lot of fun. And that actually brings me to my next question, and that was, what kind of partners do we typically have in some of these events?
That's a great question. So we love to partner with university professors or with organizations that are interested in doing these kind of things. In fact, last year I did this event, this exercise, with the Boulder, Colorado Chamber of Commerce. And so that was kind of cool because in that we didn't just have the ordinary diversity of citizens that we get. In this case, we actually had CEOs of local companies that would come in. And they put together their own budget, and it was fascinating to watch them go at it, you know, because they have all the tools, know-how, knowledge, background of being a CEO approaching the federal budget challenges. So we can work with just about anybody, but I one of the reasons I love college campuses so much, and you'll hear me talk about this a lot, is these problems that we have, these giant problems with the federal budget, disproportionately affect younger people. And all you have to do is spend about 5 minutes looking at what the federal government spends money on, and you realize that we really aren't investing in the future generations as much as we're investing in our seniors. And don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-senior at all. In fact, I'm a big fan of, you know, some of my favorite people are senior citizens, including my own mom.
Way to sidestep the hot water there, Phil.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But when you look at it from the federal budget perspective, I mean, and I think there's a reason for that, right? Because when people realize that when they're educated about federal budget issues, they're a much more informed citizenry, and therefore the elected officials are much more responsive to senior citizens than they are to younger people. Frankly, the biggest disadvantage young people have is they haven't been around long enough to put it together, that getting educated, being informed, and being an active member of our democratic republic means that they actually will have a bigger say. And the thing about these fiscal issues is a lot of the decisions that we make now get set in stone for decades. So we have a lot of decisions that are being made right now, and particularly in the next 2 or 3 years, you know, or even in the next, say, 5 to 10 years, there will be decisions made that affect millennials and post-millennials for the rest of their lives. So get informed, get involved, and the Conquer Coalition is a great organization to find out what's going on. And it reminds me, this goes back a long way in the American story. One of the reasons I love the name Conquer Coalition is because it brings to mind revolutionary times from the founding of our country. And a lot of the founders were really onto this issue about how, I mean, Thomas Jefferson said an informed citizenry is at the heart of a dynamic democracy. He talked about this. If you can just Google all kind of Thomas Jefferson quotes about, you know, whenever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government, and that whenever things get so far wrong as to attract their notice, they may be relied on to set them right, to make things right. And so that's what our fiscal lookouts do. That's what our volunteers, the Conquer Coalition volunteers across the country, do. Is we've got multiple deficits. We're trying to get a hold of this deficit of public trust by educating people about our budget deficits. And they are just unsustainable. And I know on your show you do such a good job of explaining why this is such a big issue. But the American people, they get it. And they're coming out of the woodwork, and I hear from people week after week, Chase. People are calling me up. They're calling you up. The Conquer Coalition is hearing from volunteers around the country. They're very, very concerned that Washington is ignoring these problems.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to the Conquer Coalition's National Political and Field Director, Phil Smith, and we're talking to Phil about volunteer and field activities and what the Conquer Coalition is doing across the nation right now. And Phil, you mentioned some really interesting stuff. I mean, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson there. I think he might be one of the more reliable quotes that I pull from whenever I'm writing an op-ed and need a quote. And I liked the dynamic that you pointed out between young people and not as young people, the retiree generation. And
I think it's really easy to expect certain stereotypes when working with those different demographic groups. And I love what I love about especially the budget exercise is usually those stereotypes are blown wide open. You know, you would expect maybe a college student to care more about, you know, their own future and investment in them. But in most cases, I hear that, you know, they're really worried about generations ahead of them and making sure programs like Social Security and Medicare are sustainable long term. So that is a really interesting dynamic. And I wanted to follow up when talking about our events, just had a fun sort of curious question. What's one of the stranger, I know there's really no dumb question, but what are some of the stranger questions you've received when giving a presentation for Concord? And maybe what are some of those standard questions that almost always come up?
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, people will ask the difference between the debt and the deficit, which is one of the most basic questions. You know, the deficit is an annual figure. You know, every year that we spend more money than we take in revenue, that gives us our annual deficits. You know, which this year it looks like we're going to finish up somewhere in the, $900 billion range for 1 year. That's just for 1 year. And so you take, when you have an annual deficit like that, you take it and add it together with all these deficits that we've had in the past, and that gives us our current national debt, which is today over $21 trillion. We get a lot of questions. I mean, there's probably like a top five or top 10 frequently asked questions. That we get. Sometimes people want us to start talking more about monetary policy. We talk more about fiscal policy than monetary policy. And for me, it's much more of a natural thing to talk about, the fiscal policy, because monetary policy, I mean, it can obviously affect things a lot with monetary policy, but you get to the heart of the matter and, you know, where are our priorities for the long term? You will find that in fiscal policy. And to me, fiscal policy is the root of all of our challenges. If we get fiscal policy right, you can use monetary policy to tweak it here and there or whatever. But fiscal policy is the most important. So that's a question we get. There are some really weird questions I get sometimes. You know, like, is there some, you know, cabal of people running the Federal Reserve or something? Like, so we are in an information age right now that's really tremendous. But I think the qualifier that we forget to use when talking about the information age is accurate information age. And that's what Concord specializes in, is providing accurate information for citizens across the country. And so that's what I like to focus on, you know, when we get these questions. And one of my challenges sometimes is to rescue the questioner, you know, is to find a good question within their crazy question that they might ask, because they've been on the internet or they've been on Facebook and they've seen all kind of crazy, rumors, or, you know, or they think that Social Security is about to run out of money tomorrow. There's all sorts of issues that we have to deal with these questions.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point there on stressing the idea of accurate information. I think that's especially important for organizations like the Concord Coalition, who are nonpartisan. You know, we rely upon the Congressional Budget Office for a lot of those underlying numbers through most of our activities and charts and that sort of thing. I know we have a lot of really engaged leaders across the country in different states doing different activities, and I'm curious, you know, with the emphasis on being nonpartisan and focusing on accurate information and trying to be fact focused, have you found that it's easy for volunteers to get involved? Are they nervous at times with any kind of added pressure? Like, what's your general experience or feeling with some of these volunteer leaders that are stepping up and getting involved?
Well, we have our volunteer base is so diverse. I mean, like, for example, in Minnesota, we've got a guy who leads our Minnesota Advisory Council, and he has been involved in commercial real estate for many, many years. So he's very, you know, he's a very sophisticated guy, and he gets, monetary policy, he gets fiscal policy. So his challenge was finding charts and finding information that was easily digestible so that he didn't get too far into the weeds when talking to people. And that's one of the things we specialize at the Concord Coalition. You know, our charts are very easy to look at. They're very easy to read. Oftentimes, you know, when you and I go to Washington and we meet with economists, they'll give us, you know, really granular, detailed information. And so it's our job at the Concord Coalition, particularly when we're in the field, to boil that down and not lose people when you're trying to do that. So I think once people see our charts and they see the chart presentation, you know, then they can give it to. But, you know, we have a lady in Florida, a fantastic woman who has been involved with the Concord Coalition for a really long time. Her name is Bobby Monroe, and she was actually the president of the Financial Planners Association for her state a few years ago. And she is just a walking quote machine. You know, she has the ability to look at a chart or look at some of this information and then really make it succinct, you know, into like a little one-liner or something. And so she can take it and really run with it. Then, you know, like any other organizations, we have, you know, we have extroverts and introverts, and we have some people that prefer to do the exercise instead of give the speeches. We have some people who want to organize a group of people. And so everywhere where we have a volunteer state leader or a state fiscal lookout, we have a network of volunteers that go along with them. And many times these leaders have recruited their own volunteers. And so they, you know, will help train people to give the chart talk presentations, or, you know, to teach a class at a local campus, maybe community college or something, or to run our budget exercise. You know, it helping us with public engagement.
And Phil, unfortunately, we're running short on time, and I still have a whole laundry list of questions I wanted to bring up. So I'll leave it with two questions. One, I know grassroots initiatives and efforts are really important to what the Concord Coalition does and everything it tries to accomplish. Do you see in your work with volunteers and all of these ground level activities, do you see that grassroots effect rising up the ranks and maybe influencing some members of Congress or leaders in different parts of the country? Or is it sort of falling on deaf ears right now because of how politically divided we are?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, our mission at the Concord Coalition is a mission of education, of educating people and citizens about these things. But I unfortunately do think that some of the people that need the most educating happen to be in the Washington, D.C. area. And so we spend time educating them, too. But one of the best things that can happen, Paul Tsongas, one of the founders of the Concord Coalition, used to say, you know, that politicians are like weather vanes, and they just go with the wind direction. So we, the people, are that wind direction. And when we educate ourselves and we're armed with information necessary, it really helps when we engage with them. But, yes, I think they're hearing it. They haven't acted on it. And they're not acting on it right now, which is why we're going back to the basics at the Concord Coalition to educate people about these issues. But the volunteers are so actively engaged. I've got a naval officer who called me up a couple of months ago and said that his professor at the Naval Academy told him that the biggest threat facing the United States was not a physical threat, but a fiscal threat. And so he immediately called the Concord Coalition up and said, what can I do to get involved? And, of course, we have a laundry list of things that people can do to get involved. So people are coming out of the woodwork. And if the politicians aren't listening in 2018, I've got a feeling that come 2019 and 2020, they're going to listen. And, of course, when they come to New Hampshire, they're going to have to listen, because the Concord Coalition has a lot of support and volunteers in New Hampshire. The same thing for Iowa, similarly in South Carolina and other places. So as they, you know, our dozen or so states that we're active in, they're going to be hearing from these educated people.
And that's why you're the National Field Director for the Concord Coalition, Phil. You answered my second question without me even having to ask it. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord Coalition National Political and Field Director Phil Smith. We've been discussing ways you can get more involved with Concord and an update on what volunteers are doing around the country right now. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby will join me to discuss why we shouldn't be too excited that Congress avoided a shutdown, at least until December 7th. Phil, thanks so much for joining Facing the Future this week.
Thank you, Chase, and best of luck to you.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Bob is not only a fiscal policy expert and regular contributor on Facing the Future. If there was a parade for all things maple, Bob would probably be the Grand Marshal. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
That's great. I look forward to that that circus. That would be terrific.
Well, we're in New Hampshire and Vermont's nearby, so there's probably something to that effect going on. So,
yeah, you're not calling me a sap, are you?
No, I'm definitely not calling you a sap. So this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I guess, what I would categorize, and maybe you'd agree, is stealth spending within the federal budget. And you recently wrote a piece sort of describing why we shouldn't be all that excited that Congress had dodged a shutdown and delayed the appropriations process until December 7th. Just to give a quick update there, five of the 12 appropriations bills were passed, so that leaves seven left to be dealt with. There's still some contentious issues there, so I have a feeling that we're still going to be experiencing perhaps another bumpy road. But before we dive into the content of your piece, I did want to ask one question, Bob, more targeted about what's going on in the budget process. Funding for a border wall has been a hot topic. Immigration has been intermittently thrown in there. Do you think those two issues could lead to a potential partial shutdown come December 7th?
It's entirely possible. It's the border wall funding has been the one thing that's been holding up the appropriations process this year, which otherwise has gone really, really smoothly. But there is a, you know, the House is willing to give the president more money for the wall than the Senate is, and Democrats can still filibuster an appropriations bill in the Senate. And so you still have a the possibility of a shutdown. It wouldn't shut down the whole government, by the way. I mean, it's important to remember that those five bills that you mentioned that have passed, those are good to go. So if you're, you know, one of those agencies is not going to shut down. It's the ones that that haven't passed yet. And Homeland Security is one of them because they haven't decided on the border wall funding.
So if you're one of the lucky few of within the five, you're fine for the next fiscal year. But it's the other seven that might be of concern. And speaking of the appropriations process, again, I think it'd be good to have a little reminder of what categories of spending this even involves on an annual basis. So can you give us a quick rundown on, you know, what entails discretionary spending and maybe a little insight on those five bills that I mentioned and you mentioned and what's already been handled for the year?
Well, the biggest discretionary spending bill is the defense bill, and that's almost $700 billion. So, you know, that's quite a bit, including, war funding. But the so-called base budget is $650 billion. And then you get health and human services, which is a big bill on the domestic discretionary side. That's $181 billion or so. So those are two big bills that have passed. And then there's some smaller ones like energy and water, the ledge branch, as they call it, legislative branch. That's Congress passing its own budget, its own operations budget. Military construction is another smaller bill that's passed. You add up the bills that have passed, and it is about 75% of discretionary spending. But we still have agriculture to go. There's a commerce, justice, and science bill, and, of course, Homeland Security, where we talked about with the border wall.
And, you know, we've talked about discretionary spending, and, you know, we've also talked about on the show in the past how there's a whole other category called mandatory spending, how discretionary really only captures about 30 to 33% of the overall budget. So we're kind of missing the point on fiscal policy and reform when we're only touching a third of the budget. What's not being talked about?
Well, I always get a kick out of it at this time of year. People are arguing about the spending bills, and, you know, they do involve a lot of money, and they're important. But this stealth spending spree that you mentioned, you know, it often goes overlooked, and it's the so-called mandatory spending programs that don't go through the appropriations process. And it is programs like Medicare and Social Security. Those are the, you know, biggest ones. Medicaid is another one. There's programs that run on autopilot. They're based on benefit formulas, and their spending is determined by those formulas and by eligibility for the benefits. And because Congress doesn't have to look at them every year, that spending just goes up automatically, along with interest on the debt, which is another category that obviously doesn't go through the appropriations process because Congress has to pay whatever it needs to pay on the debt that it's run up. So that's almost 70% of the budget between the mandatory programs, which is about 60%, and interest, which is about 8%. So while we're fighting tooth and nail about the appropriations bills, 70% of the budget is going up on autopilot.
So, Bob, why are these different areas of spending disconnected from each other? Why is it that 70% of the budget grows on its own based on some predetermined formula and demographic shifts?
Well, that's the nature of the program. Social Security and Medicare, to take those two big examples again, really wouldn't function very well as discretionary programs. You wouldn't, you know, they're intended to provide retirement security, and you wouldn't really want them to be funded on an annual basis to go through and say, well, now I guess we have to cut back on Medicare this year. We're going to cut back on Social Security this year, because people are supposed to be able to plan on their use this in their retirement planning. So you don't want to change the rules on an annual basis like that for programs. So it makes some sense to have them running on autopilot. What doesn't make sense is that we don't have a regular mechanism for reviewing those programs with an eye towards ensuring their sustainability. There's no mechanism in the budget process that requires some sort of action, and that's probably a missing piece in the budget process. But if you had something like that, you wouldn't do it on an annual basis. You'd do it on a prospective basis.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, a regular voice on the show. We're discussing what I would characterize as stealth spending in the federal budget, spending that, as Bob mentioned, effectively grows in autopilot. It's about 70% of the budget when you consider mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare and then interest on the debt. And something else we've talked about, Bob, even in with respect to discretionary spending and the appropriations process, is how the wheels were sort of greased this go around this fiscal year because of higher budget caps that were set. And that caused discretionary spending to bump up a little bit. But there's still, from what I've read and what I've heard, there's still a disparity in how quickly discretionary spending is growing versus how quickly mandatory spending is growing. Can you give a little bit of an explanation there? Maybe give some numbers on how much mandatory is growing compared to discretionary?
Yeah, they did help. One of the reasons that we actually passed some appropriations bills this year is that Congress decided to spend a little bit more than they had planned to. And so there was a bump up in both defense and non-defense spending, and that was due to a budget agreement that was enacted earlier in the year, and that certainly helped. But even with that bump up in discretionary spending, if you look at the increase that's projected from last fiscal year, 2018, which just ended September 30th, to the current fiscal year, which just started, you can see what the trajectory is like. Discretionary spending is projected by the Congressional Budget Office to go up by $82 billion this year over what we spent last year. And mandatory spending is projected to grow by $173 billion in the coming year. And that's the part that nobody scrutinizes, nobody looks at. It just happens automatically. Plus, interest is supposed to rise by about $74 billion. So, you know, if you do the math, it's about 75% of the spending increase that's projected for the current fiscal year is going to happen on autopilot without any debate or without any votes being taken.
I think that's really interesting when you factor in the reality that, you know, Congress agreed to raise the caps for discretionary spending, and we saw an influx of spending that, you know, helped boost budget deficits higher than were originally projected. But at the same time, the stuff that's already cooked into the books is still growing at a faster rate. Can you maybe give a little bit of insight on the current fiscal projections, maybe from the CBO's perspective or our perspective, on how much deficits are expected to grow, and if there's any exacerbating factors that have occurred in the last year, year and a half?
Well, as we enter the new fiscal year, the projected deficit for this year is $981 billion. That's up from around $800 billion that we think we just experienced for the last fiscal year. We don't have the final numbers yet, but it'll be about $800 billion. And that's going up to $1 trillion in 2020. So the budget deficit is on a upward trajectory. And keep in mind, this is with a strong economy. It's not like, you know, before when we had $1 trillion deficits and there was a deep recession. So this is really indicating a serious problem. One of the big items from the last fiscal year was, of course, the big tax cut, which is projected to increase deficits over the next 10 years by $1.9 trillion, even accounting for dynamic growth, so-called dynamic scoring. So you figure that there will be some positive economic feedback, and yet still revenues would be lower by almost $2 trillion than they would have been otherwise. So that was the big factor in the upward projections for the deficit. There was also, as we mentioned, some upward adjustment on spending that happened. But again, on the spending side, the upward increase is that stealth spending that flies below the radar screen.
One thing you mentioned that caught my attention was, even if, you know, we don't on an annual basis look at mandatory spending as part of the budget process, but there's a danger to be had if we don't look at it at all. Can you share what might happen if we fail to act on any kind of reform on some of these programs? And I'm not talking about cutting out benefits and harming current retirees, but actually engaging in long-term sustainable reform on some of these issues facing the systems. You know, what are the dangers or potential ramifications of doing nothing?
Well, I think that the thing that I worry about most is a slow, steady decline in standards of living. And because, you know, a crisis in some ways is beneficial because it prompts action. And I don't know that we're going to see some sort of big crisis from this. But what we will see, and I think we're seeing it already, is less investment in the future, less retirement security, and eventually higher taxes, because you are going to have to, we're not seeing higher taxes now because we're shoving that unpleasant burden off into the future. But I think that, you know, the lesson here is that with lack of investment, there will be a slow erosion and a decline. And I worry about that, because we should be doing more to invest in the future.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, discuss stealth spending and the need to actually confront these issues and face the future. Always a pleasure, Bob, to have you on the show.
Well, I don't know how pleasurable it is, but anyway, happy fiscal new year.
Always insightful. How about that? Always a pleasure to have you on because of the insight you offer. We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. The debt limit is more trouble than it's worth. It's a topic you haven't heard much about lately and likely won't until around March of next year, when the debt limit will potentially be reinstated. Between now and then, the debt will be allowed to grow at will, not as if the debt limit ever actually controlled debt growth, as Congress has raised it every time it has wanted to or needed to, like right now, and the debt is over $21.5 trillion. The original purpose of creating a statutory debt limit in 1917 was not to prevent the government from running up too much debt, but to remove the requirement that Congress authorize individual issuances of debt. The intent was to help ensure that sufficient and timely credit would be available to finance World War I. 100 years later, things are very different. The main use of the debt limit now is politically motivated, often used as leverage that can prevent the government from paying its bills on time,
putting the nation's creditworthiness at risk and threatening a global financial crisis. In recent years, 2011, 2013, and 2017 specifically, the nation was needlessly driven to the brink as policymakers debated over conditions for a debt limit increase in order to avoid a partial default on government obligations. Financial markets, government creditors, and the public looked on with increasing horror and frustration. Yet, there's no guarantee that similar brinkmanship on the debt limit will not be used in the future. If we want to move beyond crisis management and back to rational budgeting, we should recognize that the debt limit has itself become part of the problem. It begins with a basic misunderstanding of what the debt limit even does. Many people naturally assume that a, quote, debt limit actually exerts control over the nation's fiscal policies. It does not. Unlike budget process mechanisms such as caps on appropriations or pay-as-you-go or pay-go rules that require spending increases or tax cuts to be paid for, the debt limit places no such restrictions on specific tax and spending decisions. All it does is prevent the government from issuing debt to pay the bills that it has already run up. It's like trying to curb your personal spending by tossing your unpaid credit card bills in the trash. Moreover, the limit amount itself lacks any direct ties to the state of the economy or spending and tax decisions. Politicians simply pick a number and then fight about it, which usually turns the congressional budget process into a series of short-sighted, makeshift deals cobbled together at the last minute. The pointlessness of this exercise is demonstrated by the fact that neither political party has proposed a budget plan that would avoid further increases in the current limit. In fact, as I mentioned before, they recently just suspended it. Studies have found that even getting close to the debt limit can cause enough uncertainty in the markets for Treasury securities that borrowing costs can increase. As a matter of sound fiscal policy, there is no good reason to have a hard dollar cap on the debt. Washington's goal instead should be first to stabilize the debt and then bring it down to a sustainable level relative to the economy. Even if the debt continues to grow, it will become less of a threat if it grows more slowly than the economy. Following World War II, for example, the debt was $242 billion and 106% of GDP, or the size of our economy. By 1974, the debt had grown in dollar terms to $344 billion, but had shrunk to only 23% of the economy. Some argue that the debt limit provides useful leverage to extract fiscal reforms that would be hard to enact otherwise. However, this is ultimately a, quote, trigger that must never be pulled, so it's pretty much of limited value. Refusing to pay the nation's bills would damage the nation's creditworthiness and economy while doing nothing to address the underlying mismatch between federal spending and revenues that is producing higher debt. If politicians want to reform the debt limit so that it might do some good, they could come up with a way to tie the nation's debt to an economically relevant standard, such as the growth rate of the economy. They could also align debt limit increases with the policy decisions that require more borrowing. For example, the House used to follow a rule that packaged debt limit increases with votes on budget resolutions. This procedure ensured that the additional debt incurred under the budget resolution was approved alongside it. Now that the debt limit has simply become an opportunity to provoke a crisis, it would be best to scrap the current system. The real solution to unsustainable debt is not to risk default, but to enact more fiscally responsible policies in the first place. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.